Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Oh, no, the gas prices again. Here's the situation, ladies and gentlemen. Dramatic photographs emerging from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. What is described as a drone attack, bringing offline approximately 5.7 million barrels per day of Saudi crude oil production. It's about 5% or 1/20th what this planet produces and consumes in an average day. Unknown at this point how long it will be offline. What we do know is that U.S. President Trump authorized the immediate relaxation of U.S. strategic reserves and that's the sort of thing that would happen in wartime, or that's the sort of thing that would happen in an emergency. However, even reserves in countries around the world are themselves limited. We don't know if any more attacks will happen. We don't know exactly who is behind this. Houthi rebels have claimed responsibility, but, you know, you have guerrilla warfare practitioners claim responsibility for things that they didn't do all the time because they just want to scare their opponent. U.S. President Trump saying that the U.S. was waiting until it determined definitively if Iran was involved, prospect of military intervention always there. You can just follow the president's tweets from hour to hour to try to figure out what's going to happen next. Professor Ken Christie from Royal Roads University, he's the head of the Human Security and Peacebuilding Program, joins us now with his thoughts. Professor, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Adam. How are you?
I am looking at the global economy, wondering how much more it can take before we have some sort of catastrophic recession, to be honest. The oil price issue, just the latest in a number of concerning signs. Your thoughts on the larger implication of this attack?
Well, this is probably the worst disruption to the crude supplies on record. I think it's something like we're losing 5.7 million barrels of crude oil per day.
Yeah.
And if you look at what happened during the Iranian Revolution between 1978 and 1979, we were losing something like 5.6 billion. There's a nice figure in the Globe and Mail this morning which shows this. So it's a pretty serious event. It's a pretty serious attack, and it will definitely put the energy supplies in a state of crisis, and we'll raise the price of gas, no doubt. It'll probably go up to maybe even $75 a barrel, which is really quite dramatic.
Interesting. I was looking at where Saudi exports actually go, and number one is not a surprise. It's the global behemoth that everybody's struggling to supply right now. It's China, approximately one quarter of Saudi production that I was looking at, particularly with this disruption, generally goes to China. So they're going to be looking elsewhere. Many other countries, though, that are reliant on this continuous supply of oil to feed their refineries will suddenly be left scouring the globe. What do you expect to arise from that?
Well, I think there'll be a lot of boost in oil output. I mean, again, there was a report in the Globe and Mail today that Alberta, for instance, in Canada, is weighing this boost oil output in the wake of attacks and talking about, you know, talking about the increase in production in the oil patch to for crude shipped by train, for example. So again, Alberta considering relaxing oil production cuts to allow companies to export more crude. The United States doing exactly the same thing. So again, relaxing controls and trying to get the oil from elsewhere and not being completely reliant on Saudi Arabia. The bottom line is we have been very reliant on the Middle East for our oil and for cheap oil. And it may be time to start thinking about how we can use other kinds of energy sources, and certainly how we can use our own oil in the West and elsewhere.
For all the praise that Barack Obama gets in terms of the rather progressive policies that he pursued during his two terms in office, I don't often hear it mentioned that there's probably no other president in the history of the United States of America who saw oil production increase in terms of barrels per day as much as Barack Obama did. It was something like a 350% increase during his two terms. The U.S. becoming almost the world's number one producer during that time in a relatively short interval.
Well, I think also, again, there was a crisis, for instance, in Libya during this period, the Libyan civil war, etc., and other kinds of natural disasters. So that didn't help. There's certainly been those kinds of increases. But also, what we have to understand is that this oil, these attacks on the oil installations in Saudi Arabia is pretty destabilizing for the entire region.
Yes.
And once you have a destabilized region in an area as volatile as the Middle East, we have huge political and economic problems for the rest of the world.
I wanted to ask you about the security implications here. What, for our listeners' benefit, when we say Houthi rebels, who is that? Who are we talking about?
Well, the Houthis are a minority group in Yemen who have, they're the Shia group, basically, and the whole conflict escalated in 2015. The Houthis seized control of much of the west of the country. They forced the president, Adraba Mansour Hadi, he had to flee abroad. And then Saudi Arabia and its allies, like some of the Gulf states, for instance, who are Sunni, started an air campaign aimed at restoring Mr. Hadi's government. Now, this air campaign has gone on for a long time. The United Nations says at least probably 7,500 civilians have been killed by this. 80% of the population, though, almost 24 million people are in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. 10 million relying on food aid to survive. So there's a real massive risk of starvation in Yemen. And this air campaign by the Saudis and by their allies in the Middle East has really caused a problem. I mean, I lived in Dubai for 7 years.
Yes.
I know quite a bit about Yemen, and it's an extremely impoverished country. Almost parts of it are almost like living in the Stone Age in some ways. So the Saudis, with their technology, were bombing this country into oblivion almost. And, you know, the reaction now is, well, they're going to start attacking Saudi. Now, whether these attacks are coming from Iranian soil or not, we're not quite sure. I mean, the U.S. is now starting to implicate the Iranians in the attack, as are the Saudis. But, you know, Yemen, this is a terrible humanitarian disaster for Yemen, whatever the cost of the oil, etc.
Do we know who launched this attack? I know Houthi rebels have claimed responsibility, but as you and I have discussed in the past, you know, anytime there's a terrorist attack or any attack in a guerrilla warfare situation, the practitioners of that guerrilla warfare will claim responsibility for it so as to scare their opponents, even if it wasn't them who did it. So do we know?
Well, these wars are proxy wars, of course. I mean, this is a war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and they're using other forces like the Emirates, for instance, and like the Houthi rebels to fight each other in some ways. We don't really know 100%. It's kind of unlikely to me that the Houthis would have the technology and the ability to launch these. These are like 500 miles away from Saudi Arabia. It probably makes more sense that these were launched in Iran. Mm-hmm. Who actually launched the attacks is, of course, another matter of contention, because there's many different kinds of groups who have a gripe with Saudi Arabia, for instance. So it's hard to know. It could be Hezbollah, for instance. It could be Hezbollah working with the Houthis. We don't really know, and that's why there's a lot of uncertainty at the moment.
Yeah.
And that's why the United States is unwilling to sort of say, well, it is Iran. And that's why Saudi is unwilling to say it is Iran, because we don't want to get the wrong person, you know.
I know you would be able to answer this question because, of course, it's what you study as a scholarly pursuit. But Ken Christie, I think if I asked most people out there to name the top three countries on Earth in terms of defense spending, they'd get number one and two right, but they'd probably get number three wrong. Number one, we know, our friends and neighbors, the United States of America, the largest military force to ever exist. Number two, the emerging superpower, the People's Republic of China. Number three in terms of military spending on this planet is Saudi Arabia. You think most people know that it's number three?
I don't think people know that. I mean, I think all of the Gulf states spend incredible amounts on weapons. I lived in the United Arab Emirates for, as I say, 7 or 8 years, and the amount of arms fairs that they had in the Gulf was just astonishing to me. And I always wondered, what are they actually doing with these weapons? Because they never seem to use it. They never seem to have a really big military. But now they're using it. Now they're using all that technology against countries like Yemen, etc. And, you know, Saudi Arabia has a huge amount of weapons at its disposal. Whether it has some of the inability to use some of these weapons, I'm surprised at, because I didn't think that their armies were that professional. Yeah. But they are using them, and they're using them in an incredibly destructive way against very poor people in the region. And this is, you know, they will never use them against Iran, because Iran will attack back. Iran has got a lot of sophisticated weaponry of its own, and they will not just simply lay back and take this kind of interference.
I wanted to ask you about that, because Saudi Arabia spends, depending on who you ask, between $70 and $80 billion a year on defense. About one tenth of the Americans, but they're still number three on earth. It's about 9% of their GDP, which is one of the top, if not the top, figures I have seen. Why are the Americans thinking about attacking at all? Why is Saudi Arabia not fully capable of striking back at whoever did this?
Well, they might be, but of course the United States is heavily involved in the region, and this would maybe cause a war, a serious war. I mean, what they're doing in, of course, Yemen, and part of the reason is a lot of people don't really care what happens in Yemen. It's a tragedy. It's a humanitarian tragedy. But what happens between Saudi Arabia and Iran, because Saudi Arabia has all these oil supplies, is really important. Yeah. And it's the same with Iraq. Why did we go into Iraq? Well, it was to secure the oil supplies. It wasn't because we really believed Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. So if a country attacks Saudi Arabia and disrupts the oil supply and disrupts the entire process of capitalism, and oil is one of its main, one of the main things capitalism runs on, then this is a serious problem.
All right. You're a busy guy. We have to let you get back to work, but I wanted your knowledge and insight on this. What will you be watching most closely moving forward to see if there will be continued armed conflict?
I'll be watching what comes out of the White House, because, you know, they have already made quite, you know, the entire Trump administration has turned against Iran, and they walked away from that nuclear deal, for instance.
Yes.
And this is a serious problem. I mean, Obama worked quite hard to get that deal, and Trump came into office and simply walked away from it. They become very belligerent towards Iran and in favor of Israel, of course. So this is what I'm going to be looking at. What's going to be happening in the White House next? Because that will determine what happens if they attack Iran, or if they launch strikes on Iran, and whether these tensions will escalate. But one thing I would say is it's a very, very worrying moment in the history of the Middle East at the moment.
Indeed, the world's number three spender in terms of military power attacked, half of its oil infrastructure knocked offline in one strike. Will the retaliation come? In what form will it come? These questions yet to be answered. Professor Ken Christie, thank you as always for your knowledge and insight. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Adam.
All right, take care. But I think most people wouldn't know that. Number three defense spender on the face of this planet is Saudi Arabia. They have the best technology, the best weaponry. They've got piles of money to spend on it as well. Although half of their oil infrastructure just got taken offline. And that's where a lot of their money comes from. Somebody hit them where it hurts, and somebody hit them hard. Whoever it is can expect to get hit back. And the West may well be pulled into any ensuing conflict. So we'll watch this very closely, in addition to the economic impacts of a 5% of the world's oil supply being knocked offline with one drone attack. All right, quick break. Let's check out headlines first from the CFAX 1070 newsroom, see what the newsroom's working on.
Keeping you informed, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
By the way, I was just recounting to someone the complicated history of Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, the unification of what had been warring houses for a long, long time. The House of Saud, of course, coinciding with the founding of Aramco, the Arab American Oil Company, and, well, the rest is history. The Americans have valued the relative stability that the House of Saud brought to that region. And because of that, the Americans turned a blind eye to the Wahhabism, which, or the Salafism, or Salafist practices that, well, many of you may or may not be aware of. But in terms of the values that we tend to espouse, involving human rights, involving the separation of church and state, any number of other things that we hold dear, Saudi Arabia, not so much. And the Americans have largely allowed it to flourish because of the lucrative nature, or indeed the necessity, of maintaining stable access to what was at one time the world's major oil supply. Politics is all about getting along with people you don't like. That is it in a nutshell. And I think it holds true there as much as anywhere else. Let's go to Dave. Hey, Dave, welcome to Open Lines. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was just wondering, how long would it take to get everybody out of poverty if all the powers in the world took all that money they spend on war and weapons and put it towards feeding the hungry?
You know, Dave, that's a really interesting question. If you took all the money out of what you spend on wars, what you're essentially doing is retasking the human beings that you have engaging in that warfare, the soldiers, the people at the munitions factories. You're presuming that they could all become farmers, could all become truck drivers, could all become another task involved with feeding the hungry. You can write all the checks you want, but if we don't have the people in the right places doing the right jobs, the real economy always has its limits. So I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah. We're thinking.
It's one of the things I think about. I know you've probably heard the term Jeff Bezos, or the name Jeff Bezos. He's currently the world's richest man, and I always see people saying, well, you know, if Jeff Bezos gave away 10% of his money, he could have every children in the world going, or child in the world going to school because the school costs this much, and I got out my calculator. I'm thinking, well, no, Jeff Bezos has $150 billion, conceptually speaking, because he owns controlling shares in a company called Amazon. Now, could you sell those shares and buy, I don't know, 100 billion oranges instead, or something along those lines? Amazon's a company. Doesn't matter who owns it. It's still going to do what it does every day, and you can't necessarily transform that into food that people will eat unless you're proposing to retrain all of those workers to be farmers and giving them actual dirt to farm on. A long-winded way, Dave, of saying I don't know how to answer your question, and I'm not sure there's anyone who actually can.
Well, there's a lot of dirt out there that could be farmed, and there's not a whole lot to do to be a farmer. I mean, it's not rocket science.
That's true. You got to find the people willing to do it, though, Dave, and sometimes that means paying them more, which means it costs even more to get it done.
Well, all that money we spend on weapons and wars, I think, would probably cover it.
Well, but do you think the people who work in the munitions factories would be like, all right, I'll be a farmer. Just keep my paycheck coming. I'll go be a farmer tomorrow.
We don't give them a choice.
Oh, I see. Well, see, that's the problem. When you start planning the economy, eventually you run up against the coercion problem. And various governments have figured that out over the years. I'm glad that we got to it so fast.
Good.
Have yourself a good day, Dave. Take care. 250-386-1161, star 1070. Ah, yes, the paradox of freedom of choice as well as guaranteeing certain provisions be met. You know, eventually, if we wandered down that thought experiment path long enough, we'd invent the need for taxation in society in general. Let's go to James next. Hey, James, welcome to Open Lines. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, what's going on in front of your station right now?
I don't know. What do you see outside the station?
Some sort of protest against climate change.
Oh, is there? I'll look into that,
yeah.
James.
I had to go around the block. I was going to turn down that street and buy something, but I had to go around the block.
Is the road, like, are there a bunch of people in the road, or what's going on?
Yeah, they're blocking the road. You can't get through.
Well, I'll have to look out the window, James.
And you got a big banner across your front door.
Oh, I should probably look into that.
I thought they were
all right.
Hypocritical, making us drive around burning oil, wearing rain gear made out of rubber. Big banner. It's made out of either plastic or paper, so kind of hypocritical, but whatever.
You know what, James? I'm in my own little world up here on the third floor, so I'll look into that, all right?
Yeah, man.
All right. Take care. You too. 250-386-1161, star 1070, a free call on your wireless device. Let's go next to, I think it's Tracy. Hey, Tracy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Regarding the bus crash at Bamfield, it's my opinion that the roads aren't the problem. It's the way people drive that even the two deaths on Trans-Canada by Lee Road there, that's still driver error. It doesn't matter what the road is. People aren't driving to the conditions. Like right now, with the motorcyclist being killed, and them saying, like, they're investigating the other driver, but they're saying that the weather, the roads are wet and all that. Well, the speed limit is at ideal conditions. And I've said that the police shouldn't even let you go the 10 over. So when the roads aren't at ideal conditions, they absolutely should not be letting anybody go even one over, because that's what the speed limit is at ideal conditions.
You really think though there's a change between safe and unsafe between 50 and 51? It's only 1 kilometer per hour.
But if you give people one, then they take 2, 3, 7, 14, 38. There was my daughter read an article off of her phone yesterday that there was an idiot in Manitoba going 161 or something like that in a 60-kilometer-an-hour construction zone.
No, really?
When I was living in Edmonton, they were doing what they call the ring road going around the city. And the construction zone was 60 for like 20 kilometers. And people were still driving 90 to 100 through it. Hmm. And blaring their horn at me because I was going 60. Tailgating me because I'm going 60. That's the speed limit. Okay. And it doesn't say when workers present. It was no matter what time of day. Same thing like with the playground zones I've said on here before. That the speed limit is 30 from sun up to sundown. 365 days a year.
I thought it was 8 to 5.
And I've asked police, why don't you enforce it? And they said, well, there's more important. No, there's not more important. You guys sit there and ticket people going more than 30 in a school zone when kids are in the classroom. They're not even outside. Well, a playground, there could be kids, like infants, with their parents, and there's no enforcement at playground zones. So it's all drivers. Like, it doesn't matter what the road is. If that road up at Bamfield used to be a logging road, and logging trucks were able to maneuver it, then there's no reason why it's probably been slightly improved to become a highway. I'm not saying ideal, but it's got to be in better condition than it was as a logging road. So if the trucks could do it as a logging road, then anybody should be able to do it when it's not a logging road anymore. It's all driver error.
There's got to be some sort of a reasonable threshold, though, Tracy, because you can argue that on any unsafe road and say, well, look, the road's clearly unsafe. They should have been going slower. Where is that reasonable limit, do you think?
At the speed limit, or if, like I'm saying, like if it's...
Because we don't know. I don't know how fast the bus was going. Like, do you know how fast the bus was? Because I don't. I don't actually know if the bus was going.
No, well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. If the conditions weren't ideal, visibility was limited, it was wet, foggy, whatever, you got to slow right down. If you have to go 10 kilometers an hour, you have to go 10 kilometers an hour. I was a courier on Salt Spring for 2.5 years almost.
Yeah.
So you drive to the conditions.
But what I'm asking you is that the only way to know if you're driving to the conditions is if you crash. I guess you weren't driving to the conditions. Like, it's tautology, right? How do you know in advance?
Well, I've said that everybody should have to take a defensive driving course from a reputable company like Young Drivers. That all these mom and pop places that just take your money and pass you, they don't really teach you anything.
So many times
I'm driving behind these tiny driving schools that the driving instructor isn't even teaching. They're just sitting there as a supervisor. I'm yelling at them, like, don't just sit there. If the person at the wheel is hesitant and whatever, do your job and teach them. You shouldn't be taking, like, I know I took Jungle Drivers and I'm promoting it, but you shouldn't even be on the road taking your learning how to drive.
Here's something I don't get.
You should take that in a capsule, like a simulator, before you can get on the road.
If I'm an unscrupulous driving school, your supposition is that I'll just take money and pass people without really checking to see if they can drive. Why would I do that, Tracy, when I can take their money, fail them, take their money again, fail them again, and take their money, and then maybe let them pass after they've done it 3 or 4 times? Wouldn't being harder be making me more money if that's what I was trying to do? Seems to me it would. Not that I would do that.
I took my air brakes course in Edmonton, and the place that I went to, you could argue both sides of that they didn't let anybody walk out having failed. It was only a 20-question multiple choice. You were allowed 4 mistakes. If you got more than 4 mistakes, they would tell you which ones you got wrong, and you had to sit there and go back and sit down and try to figure out which of the remaining answers was the right one. And if you still got more than four wrong, they would send you back until you basically eliminated every wrong answer to finally get the right one.
So it sounds like they wouldn't let you go until you learned your lesson and you were a safe driver.
Correct.
Isn't that what they're supposed to do?
Yeah. Well, okay. That's what you're saying. If you want to make money, you'll fail people. Well, this company was not doing that. They were insisting that you didn't leave until you passed.
Well, I'm glad that's out there because I wouldn't want a bad company doing bad things. Tracy, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 250-386-1161, star 1070. Quick break. More calls after this.
This is Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Got somebody texting and complaining. He says, you let Tracy ramble on too long saying nonsense. Well, caller or texter, you are welcome to your opinion. Tracy is also welcome to his opinion, which I'm not really sure what it was, but we all listened very carefully. Let's go to Ken next. Hey, Ken, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Adam. And this is further to your earlier discussions today about earthquakes.
Yeah.
And, Adam, there's a program that runs from San Diego right up to Bellingham called Project Impact.
Yes.
And it's a program designed to help homeowners improve their homes to resist the effects of an earthquake. Now, locally, we have many programs, of course, but they're designed more to tell people what to have in the event of an earthquake.
Yes.
And the supplies that they'll need for the first 72 or more hours that after an earthquake may occur. Project Impact is one designed to help all those homes that were built before building codes. And there are thousands, tens of thousands of them within the city area.
Yeah, there would be.
That in the event of an earthquake are subject to falling down.
Interesting. How do you retrofit an older home to make it more able to resist a large earthquake? I know you're never going to make it perfect, but what are some of the changes that get done?
Well, some of the changes are to ensure that the building itself is bolted to an adequate foundation, and that the connections between the bottom plate and the studs and the joists above are all secure, and you put in something that is called a shear wall.
Yeah.
It helps to stop the home from tipping over itself. So it won't bounce off and it won't tip off the foundation.
The idea of a house being launched upward off of its foundation is terrifying in terms of the sheer power it would take to do that. And it is scary because that's exactly what happens in these large earthquakes, isn't it?
It is. It is, exactly. And I had the good fortune to attend classes at the University of Washington and other classes in Seattle. And to give classes here in the city for free for a number of years on how to carry out this work by a homeowner without the assistance of highly paid professionals.
I don't know if I'd be confident in my own carpentry work when it faced the biggest test it'll ever face in terms of the big earthquake. But maybe those out there are a little more handy than I am if they want to do it themselves.
Well, anyone with a degree in economics can certainly hammer a nail.
Yeah, well, you know, on one hand, and then there's the... Never mind, that's a bad economics joke. I shouldn't say that. Ken, I thank you for calling in. I do have a little bit of a memory of this being talked about here in the Victoria area, and you're absolutely right. You know, when I was younger, I lived over on Cedar Hill, and our house, when was that made? I think it was 1920 or something like that. The idea of seismic retrofitting was but a dream at that point, Ken, so I'm pretty sure it was not seismically reinforced.
Well, in the city of Seattle, they hold classes in the libraries to instruct people on how to do it. And the community centers there have little tool libraries where the homeowner can borrow tools so that they can do it. And it's really rather of a modest cost, and any little thing that is done is an improvement. You don't have to do it 100%. You just have to do something.
Very true. Ken, thanks for calling in and reminding me about that. I appreciate it.
I think I might give another class in the spring.
Oh, there you go. Hey, if you do, give us a show. We'd be interested in looking into that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Adam.
All right. We'll talk to you later, Ken. Take care.
Bye-bye.
250-386-1161. Just, I'm taken by the sheer force, the power that these earthquakes unleash. Imagine you have to bolt your house down because the earth will press up on it with such force so fast that it will literally launch your house in a very real sense off of its foundation. Not far, maybe a couple of inches, maybe a couple of feet in terms of a huge wave going by. But just imagine the force of lifting the entire earth up, even a few inches. Imagine the power, the energy that takes. Just it boggles my mind when we hear about after these huge earthquakes where there will be a huge fracture along the seafloor that wasn't there before. And the reason it's there, it's because the rock has moved either laterally a number of meters with different plates going in different directions, or you'll see the seafloor either drop a couple of meters. Imagine the millions of tons of force of all the seawater weighing down above that bottom, or even more scary, imagine the force required to push that seafloor up a few meters, like Atlas lifting the weight of the world on his shoulders in the myths and legends of old. That's where the tsunami comes from, by the way. It's when the seafloor itself moves enough that you get heaven only knows how many tons of seawater displaced in a very short amount of time. That is what actually causes the tsunami. It's the literal ocean floor either lifting up or falling down by as much as 3 to 6 or even more feet. Just, it boggles the mind. Hey, Ron, talking about the earthquake again, feeling all existential, little bit of dread, not very much, though, pretty good today. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, I want to bring you back to Earth with something more mundane, Adam.
The good, I need something to even me out here, Ron. This is good. All right, go.
Okay. The mayor of Port Alberni calls for improvements. Steve Wallace calls for improvements. What they're doing is dancing around the euphemism for paving that road. And you asked, very puzzled, why it isn't paved.
Yeah.
And I'll give you a very good reason why it's paved. As long as it remains a logging road, it will never be paved. Yeah. Why is that? Whether you've got logging roads or mining roads, all industrial roads are built to take heavy, heavy trucks. Those trucks stop and start and stop and start. That's where potholes come from in a gravel road. Look at the state of the streets around Victoria that we often complain about. Imagine the forces on a paved road out there multiplied several times. Those trucks would break up paved roads just so fast it wouldn't be funny. That's why industrial companies don't pave, because it's a futile, pointless exercise. So as long as it's going to remain a logging road, it will never be paved. In other words, the government would have to buy it and industrial operations would have to seize so it becomes a tourist recreational road, in which case you have to compensate the logging company. They'd have to have some other gravel road to support their operations. So there's the conundrum, Adam.
Yeah,
and Transport Minister Trevina needs to be made aware of that. That's the harsh fact of industrial operations. It started life as a logging road. It's been a logging road for many years. And the mere fact that it's now being used for recreational and tourist traffic doesn't change its Monday to Friday use.
No, that's very true. Ron, your logic is sound. I can't see any flaws in it.
Thank you very much.
Ron, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I'm just looking at a map here of how much road or how much territory would actually have to be purchased, because Port Alberni is a lot closer to the east coast of Vancouver Island than it is to the west coast of Vancouver Island. If you want to get all the way down to Bamfield, which is just north of the Pacific Rim National Reserve. So there's most of the width of Vancouver Island separates those two areas, and most of that is largely, not totally, of course, but largely untouched wilderness. If they wanted to pave that road that entire way, I wonder if anybody's actually computed the costs on that. Not to suggest that there is a cost on safeguarding human lives, except there totally is, and governments literally deal with it every day as they decide which roads will get paved due to safety purposes or for safety purposes, and which roads may remain unpaved gravel logging roads. We will continue to look into this story. Right now, I think our focus and our attention should be on those who are grieving, those who have lost friends, loved ones, family members, the young people at the University of Victoria, many of them who are on this trip, 45 students on that bus. They all experienced that horrific crash. 43 of them survived that crash, and we don't know the extent of any injuries that they may be dealing with at this point. But perhaps the conversation about the intricacies of how to obtain a logging road and ensure it gets paved, that's an important conversation. It's one we're going to have. I also, in these early days, do not want to lose sight of the fact that these two young people are dead. Their friends survived them, their colleagues in terms of fellow students surviving them. And we want them to know that many of us are thinking of them in what I can only assume must be an awful, awful time. The fragility of life, something I reflect on more often than I would prefer doing this job covering the news, but it is what it is. We talk about the truth on this show every day, and our motto, although it's not really official, is that we do our best to look the truth in the eye every day. See the complicated parts, the intricate parts, the parts we'd prefer not be there, yet they are there all the same. So we must know them to be able to deal with them and properly navigate them. All right. Have a great day, everybody. I am going to, well, I'll be with you bright and early tomorrow morning, as usual. We'll throw to the newsroom and the Bell Talk Radio Network. Mark Brenny's back at 3. I am back at 9 a.m., and I will see you tomorrow morning. Take care.